in the manifestations tonight, the main theme was about your needs being met. You know, if there's nothing too hard for God, and that He cares about all the little things, and you know, when you hear a word of prophecy like that, there's such an uplifting thing that happens in our hearts. You know, I don't know. I never get tired of hearing those words about how God will take care of everything. And I think we could stand to hear them every day. So it's always wonderful to have that in a fellowship. But that's true about the prophecy and the word too. Like we talked a little bit, I think the first session about types and shadows, you know. And Joseph is a type. Usually you can distinguish them by saying, like, what's the difference between a type and a shadow, is that people are more like types and shadows are events. Or so the thing about a type, I don't know if I said this before, is it makes a blow. It's like an imprint. And you can see what it's shadowing or what it's foretelling. And it's kind of like a prophecy, only a future prophecy, where it's telling the future about something that is going to happen. But because it's just a blow or an imprint, it's very important that we don't spiritualize it too much. Because I went on the internet this last week and I started pulling off all the different things that other teachers have done on the type of Joseph, and you wouldn't believe how it gets really spiritual, you know, I mean, to where they're trying to find a comparison in almost every single event in his life. And it breaks down if you try to do that. It's only supposed to be a blow, an imprint, or parts of it that you can grab onto, because we're looking back, seeing what Jesus Christ did, then we see what the comparisons are. But you can't go through Joseph's life and say, okay, every single little thing that happened to him is, you know, something about Jesus Christ. But the overall theme of Joseph is the sufferings and the glory. And all that happens to Joseph in the early part of his life culminates in the fact that he gets to be the right-hand man for Pharaoh. And so it's the trials and the things that we're going to read about what he went through. The whole focus then is that we get to the glory, you know, because that's the culmination. And that was the same thing with Jesus Christ, is that he had to go through this time period on earth and then go through all of the trial and dying and being persecuted and all that stuff. But now he's seated on the right hand of the throne of God. You know, whoa. You know, it says that we're seated right next to him. And so looking at Joseph, you know, we can get really excited because we know that this prophecy has already been fulfilled. All the things that Joseph's life points to. So we start in Genesis 37. The first part of what the type is that Joseph is the beloved son. And it's kind of like what we had talked about last time with Isaac. You know, Isaac was the unique one. He was the only begotten of the father. So he had this specific aspect of sonship that he was representing. Well, Joseph represents the son who is really loved of his father. Read verses 1 through 4 here first. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old. What? 17. Okay, we have to remember this. His whole adventure starts when he's 17. Being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, that means his older brothers. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now, does it say that he did an evil report? No, he brought to his father their evil. So he wasn't telling his father anything, but, you know, probably Jacob already. And he's out taking care of the sheep. Okay? Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. I don't know if any of you ever saw the play, the Technicolor Dreamcoat one, Joseph. But a lot of people make a big deal about the coat of many colors, and from what I could see, the colors, it just means a very richly ornamented robe. It could have been in stripes where the colors were woven together. It had long sleeves, you know, and it was very long. And you can make some comparisons with the robe that Jesus' mother wove for him, how that robe was all of one piece, but it was a very special robe, okay? And this particular coat of many colors that Jacob gave to him was, it symbolized his heirship. Like, Jacob wanted Joseph to be the heir, even though he was the second to the youngest son. And he had 10 older brothers, and then he had a younger brother. And so Jacob really favors Joseph, and he calls him the son of his old age. And I read a really interesting thing about that, is that it's a Hebrew idiom meaning he's a wise son. So already, it is that Jacob is playing favorites a little bit here, where he's magnifying one of his sons above all the other ones. On the other hand, I think that even as a very young man growing up, Joseph must have exemplified someone who was going to be a leader and honored him because of that. But fortunately, that made his brothers very jealous. So even though you can see in these verses that Joseph is a favored son, or he's beloved son of his father, his brothers don't like it at all. And verse 4 says, "And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably with him." So the brothers start being a symbol of Israel. Because Israel, and especially the Pharisees and all of the religious leaders who were supposed to be the shepherds, right? They developed a hate towards Jesus Christ because of seeing his wisdom and seeing all the things that Jesus did to heal people and stuff. Gradually, more and more and more, he became hated, just like those brothers hated him. So the brothers represent Israel. So this is what happens here. Joseph has these two dreams, and I wanted to read the dreams and the idea of what he's coming as a man as well. So he's only 17, all right? And he dreams these dreams, and these dreams are very prophetic. they are telling what's going to happen in the future. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed." He was all excited about the dream, you know, because God was revealing it to him, right? "For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." Oh, no. The dream was about his brothers, oh dear. "And his brethren said unto him, Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us?" You know, after all, we're older than you. And you know, we have a lot more going for us than you ever dreamed of, little shrimp brother, you know, down there who's only 17. "And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words." Because deep inside, you know, kind of knew that this was a prophecy. And somehow, even if they didn't like it, someday it was going to come true. And we're going to see it did come true. But he has another dream. Verse 9, And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brethren and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me, bowed down to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him. Now his father loved him, right? But even his father, Jacob, did not understand these dreams, especially because it was pretty obvious that he was sun and his mother was the moon and his brothers were the stars. And he goes, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? He's asking it like the real prophecy. Are you saying something true? I mean, I love you, Joseph, but, you know, have you got this one right? And so he didn't even really believe him. His father didn't even really believe him. And his brethren, verse 11, envied him, but his father observed the saying. So his father was not quite as quick to say, oh no, that can't possibly be true, that Jacob comes around to understand more about it. So, the two dreams, the one about the sheaves, the wheat sheaf. Well, what do you know about the day of Pentecost when Jesus Christ presents his body in the resurrected form? It's the same time that they're presenting the temple. So there is a comparison with the sheaf, with Jesus representing a sheaf, and also the stars, because he's called the bright and morning star. So the sun and the moon and all the other stars are going to bow down to him being the bright and morning star. So this dream, you know, was a prophecy. It was something that was going to be fulfilled in Joseph's life, but it was also going to be, will be fulfilled in the future when all the earth is going to bow down to Christ. Isn't that cool? All right, so now let's skip over to verse 18 because it starts describing the beginning of Joseph's trial, or the sufferings. And verse 18 says, Joseph goes to seek brethren out who are taking care of the sheep. And when they, the brothers, saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, Behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say, Some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dream. Their envy really led them go way above and beyond, you know, being evil to a brother. Well, remember I said that Israel, during the time of Jesus Christ, is represented by the brothers. And the reason that they ended up killing Jesus Christ is the same reason, envy. Because they didn't have signs, miracles, and wonders. They weren't having prophecies be fulfilled. So that same, whenever you see religious envy, you know that it's serious. That it leads to murder in a very easy fashion. So they say, well, let us slay him and cast him into a pit. And verse 21, Reuben heard it. He's the oldest. Reuben is the oldest son. And he delivered him out of their hands and said, Let us not kill him. So Reuben actually steps in as an intermediary and rescues him brothers from actually. And Reuben said unto them, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So Reuben's idea was, just let's throw him in this pit, but then he was going to sneak back later and rescue him out of the pit and bring him to his father. So Reuben had this great idea. But what happened was, it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and that the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked. And behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. For he is our brother and our flesh, and his brethren were content. So that's exactly what Israel, all the leaders, did. And that way, his blood won't be on our hands. Well, that's right. But it kind of messes up Reuben's plan for rescuing him, right? Because the Ishmaelites are coming past here, and they decide to sell him. So, verse 28. Then there passed by Midianite merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now, you can see, like, the pit always kind of represents death. And so Joseph was thrown in a pit. I mean, there's some different things here. They stripped him of his robe, just thrown into a pit, which basically symbolizes death. Jesus was sold as a slave also for, that time it was 30 pieces of silver, and this one's 20 pieces of silver. He was sold as a slave, the price of a slave. And what else? They bound him and took him out, and then, so the very beginning of Joseph's suffering is actually the parallel to the time of the trial. I'm showing you this because, like, I'm showing you the parallels, but I also want to show you that the timing isn't necessarily always parallel either. Like, these events right here are at the very beginning of suffering. There's other things in the middle. And so, it doesn't just go 1-1, 2-2. Yeah. That's how prophecy works, too. Like, you can read the Old Testament, and you can read Isaiah, and you'll be reading along, and you say, oh, that one's been fulfilled already, and then you'll read another one, and it'll be talking about the end times when Christ comes back, and then it'll jump, and it'll be talking about the next temple that's going to be in the land, and you're going, like, what happened here? You know, I don't get this whole thing. But that's how future prophecy works. Is the timing is not in there. You just know that it will come to pass. And then later you look back on it and go, oh, okay, that's what happened. But you don't know it when it's happening or when you just read the verse. And if it hasn't come to pass yet, you can't speculate about it and go, oh, well, this verse is happening right now. You know, which is what a lot of people do. They study prophecy. End times prophecy, especially. You know, they're always going to try and find some obscure verse in Ezekiel to justify, you know, what's going on in Israel right now. And it just never works like that. So you have to know the overall events, and then the prophecies will unfold as they come. Ones that we can see backwards, we can understand. The ones that are forward, we can only speculate and just say, well, we know they're going to happen, and they're probably going to fit in here. But we won't know all the details of exactly how it works until it happens. But isn't that cool? I mean, that's the fact that God knew all that ahead of time and planned all this, and there's so many clear parallels. It's astounding, you know? If there were but 20 or 30 things that were parallel, you'd be going, wow, that's really great. The fact that there is almost every chapter something, you know, is just, it's really, so I guess that was kind of an aside, but anyway. Let's go over to chapter 39 now. As the sufferings continue for Joseph, he becomes a steward, a slave, in Potiphar's house. Potiphar is a captain of the guard and an officer of Pharaoh. Very high up in the ranks of the Egyptians. And Joseph, where are we? 39. Okay, verse 1. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And the Lord was with Joseph. And it was what? And he was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master the Egyptian. Even remember the record of the testimony about Jesus growing up is that he had grace on him and waxed strong as a child. Joseph is still considered a child here. And so, verse 3, his master saw that the Lord was with him. Wow. A total unbeliever saw that the Lord was with him. And that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. If you ever want to do a fun study that word prosper. Because what happens to Joseph being faithful to God all the way through, to just listen to God and follow his wisdom, what causes him to prosper. And he's just one example. Hezekiah is another example. Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he, Potiphar, made him overseer over his house. And all that he had, he put into his hand. And it came to pass from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. He left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught what he had. He didn't even know what he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. So that's, I mean, that doesn't sound like suffering. Yeah, does it? I mean, but he's still a slave, right? Even though he's the right-hand man to Potiphar, still a servant. And can't very well just up and leave job. So, but because of his wisdom, finding grace in the sight of Potiphar. So that's the part that I wanted to read that. So what happens is Potiphar's wife decides that she would like to have Joseph. And she, over and over and over again, tries to get him to sleep with her. And verse 10 says, It came to pass as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And and he says to her, back in verse 9, said, there is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he, Potiphar, kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So one of the very first things that we see in the suffering and the trial of Joseph is that he had to make up his mind to do God's will, God, despite any temptation. No? Hold your finger here, look at Hebrews chapter 4. In many ways, Joseph is in training here. You know, he's learning to be the steward, right? Because eventually he's going to be the right-hand steward of Pharaoh. But he didn't know that right then. And so, chapter 4, verse 15. We have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. So when Jesus was living here on earth and going through his life, even before his ministry started, everything he went through, he had to deal with the same temptations that we do. Amazing. And yet he was never gave in. Joseph is an example of a man who didn't give in. He could have stole from Potiphar. He could have done... Here he was just a slave. What difference does it make? No, it makes a huge difference, you know. He looked to that as an example of knowing that you could be tempted but still against it too. But anyway, so all the things that Joseph went through, he didn't give in either. And so Potiphar's wife didn't like that very much. So she sets up this whole scenario that makes it look like he's raped her. And so Potiphar didn't have anything to do except to send Joseph to prison. So that's what verse 39:20 says. And Joseph's master took him and put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. So just when you think things are going your way, you get thrown in prison for taking a stand for God, too, no less. Right? Well, you know, the same thing happened to Jesus Christ when he was put on trial for doing nothing except healing people and teaching them God's word and talking about how great God was. So one of the other temptations that Joseph probably had at this point is like, you know, hey, I'm supposed to be doing your will here. And I was really trying. So why am I in prison? This is a worse scenario than what I was doing as being a slave. So he's in the prison. Verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph. The Lord never left Joseph, did he? And showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison. And whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. So even though he was thrown in this prison, almost immediately he gets elevated to being the person of the prison's right-hand man. A bit of training for him. But the really neat thing is to see that when Joseph, because he was obedient, found favor, because God blessed him, was obedient. So, he's in prison, though. So in prison, he has two fellow prisoners. One's a chief butler and one's a chief. Both have dreams. And he interprets the dreams for them. One of the guys was good and one of the guys was bad. And tells them, hey, the guy who got reinstated to his job was the cupbearer. And he says, hey, remember me. You know, when you get out of prison, remember that I helped you. So, of course, the guy didn't remember him. And over in chapter 41 and in verse 1, it came to pass at the end of 2 full years. So he's probably been in prison for at least 3 years now and was the steward of Potiphar's house for quite a number of years. We're going to see how old he is. But what happens at the end of 2 years after the butler got restored was that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river. And now Pharaoh's dream is pretty interesting. Behold, there came up out of the river 7 well-favored cows and fat-fleshed, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, 7 other kind cows came up after them out of the river, ill-favored and lean-fleshed, and stood by the other kind upon the brink of the river. And the ill-favored and lean-fleshed kind, still a mouthful in here, did eat up the 7 well-favored and fat kind. And so Pharaoh awoke. Oh, this is a very puzzling dream. He was very puzzled. But he dreamed another dream. Left in the second time he dreamed a dream. Behold, 7 ears of corn came up upon one stalk, rank and good. And behold, 7 thin ears blasted with the east wind sprung up after them. And the 7 thin ears devoured the 7 rank and full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Duh! It was a dream, obviously. And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream. None that could interpret. So then the butler, the chief butler, remembers, oh yeah, I had a dream once. Then came the chief butler unto Pharaoh, saying, I do remember my faults this day. Pharaoh was wroth with his servants and put me in the ward and the captain of the guard's house, both me and the chief baker. And we dreamed a dream in one night, I and he. We dreamed each man according to the interpretation of his dream. And there was with us a young man, a Hebrew, servant to the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted to us our dreams. Each man, according to his dream, it came to pass, as he interpreted to us, so it was. Me he restored into my office, and him he hanged. That was exactly what had happened. So, I mean, everything down to the letter that Joseph had interpreted before came to pass. And so the chief butler remembers this. Well, you're looking for somebody to interpret your dream? I got the man. I know who he is. So Pharaoh gets excited, verse 14, and sent and called Joseph, and they brought him out hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in early. Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream. There is none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. So this is a really neat answer that Joseph gives. He says, and Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. Wasn't this a great opportunity for him to get some glory? I mean, here, after all this time, he was in prison, you know, but he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, so to speak, and, you know, received favor from the keeper of the prison, but he was still in prison. And now he gets to appear before Pharaoh, and the first question is, well, can you interpret dreams? You know, it's not in me, but God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. How did he know that? Yeah, God had already told him what this dream was all about. So Pharaoh repeats the dream to him, which I'm not going to read again. And so jump down to verse 25. And Joseph said unto Pharaoh, the dream of Pharaoh is one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. So again, what something that's future, it's prophetic, right? So he's telling him, this is a prophecy to you. Seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dream is one. You could not figure that out by your five senses. Probably what, you know, the Egyptian trying to conjure up some, you know, idea of what these seven were. And but why did the scrawny ones eat up the fat ones? The other way around. Okay, so he tells them, seven thin and ill-favored cows that came up after them are 7 years, and seven empty ears blessed with the east wind, 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he shows to Pharaoh. Now he says that twice. What God is about to do. What God is about to do. Never takes any glory to himself. That's exactly really how Jesus Christ did too. He revealed the Father. He taught about God's goodness. He never drew the attention to himself. It was always like, I do the works that my Father does. I speak what my Father tells me to speak, you know. That's amazing. Verse 29. Behold, there come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, and there shall arise after them 7 years of famine. And all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt. Famine shall consume the land. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine falling, for it should be very grievous. For that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, because it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So, two dreams, one meaning, just means that it's established. Now therefore, let Pharaoh look out a man discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land, and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years. That's 20%. That's all they stored, was 20% of the time, the 7 years that were prosperous. And they had enough grain stored in the land of Egypt to feed all of the surrounding countries for the 7 years of famine. It brought all the wealth of each all the lands around into, as people brought their jewelry, their money, everything to buy food that had it. But all that they had saved up was 20%. Now, how did Joseph know that? That's what it would take. God, right? Yeah, revelation. So you see him walking here. And he's not saying, well, let me be the one to stand over everybody. He just said, this is what you should do. This is how to solve this problem. And verse 35, let them gather all the food of those good years that come and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh. And let them keep food in the cities, and that food shall be for store to the land against the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land perish not through the famine. And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. All his servants, too. It wasn't just Pharaoh who recognized that this was wisdom from God. It was all the people who worked and under him. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, can we find such a one as this is, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? Isn't that astounding? Even the Gentiles recognized that he was a man in whom the Spirit of God was. No, that happened to Jesus Christ too when he went to Tyre and Sidon. the woman at the well, and you know, he tells her just a little bit about her life, and she brings all her conflict. Man is a prophet. You know, he told me everything that I am. All right, where were we? 39. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "For as much as God has shown me all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto my word, and shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou." Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt." Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain on his neck. Made him to ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried before him, "Bow the knee," and he made all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." So he set him, after being in prison, also like a symbol of death, he got raised up, he got, you know, given new clothes, a new name, and Pharaoh set him at his right hand, gave him the signet ring, which means that he made the decisions for everything. We want to know what the Lord Jesus Christ is doing up next to the right hand of the throne of God? Making decisions and taking care of everything. Because all of it is committed to him. He's the steward. It's the exact same parallel. He's in charge. And, you know, there will come a time where Jesus Christ, it says in Corinthians, that he will turn all the authority back to God. When it's all straightened out and everything accomplished, then back to God. But in the meantime, he has all the authority. And verse 45, this is really neat. Pharaoh called Joseph's name Daphnath Paneah, and he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. And Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went all the land. That's exactly when Jesus Christ was resurrected. So he's raised to glory. So you see, you know, we were reading all about the sufferings and stuff. Now we get a little taste of glory time of when he's plucked out of death, raised and seated next to God's right hand, and given all authority. You know, keep your finger here and look at Philippians chapter 2. That new Jesus Christ is going to have a new name too. And he's going to have a wife. That's all in the book of Revelation. But this part has already come to pass. So, verse 7. "But made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men." He was a servant, right? When Jesus said, "And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore, God also hath highly exalted him." To go from being in the prison to being the right hand in the whole country of Egypt, that's exalted, I would say. "And given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow of things in heaven, that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Right. Everything that Jesus Christ does now, still, being at the right hand, is for the glory of the Father. Everything that Joseph did as the leader of all of Egypt was to glorify the Pharaoh. So being the right hand man, you know, is to point the glory to top guy. Pharaoh being the top guy in that case. But see that the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow. That new name back in Genesis that he gave Joseph, Zaphnath-Paneah. There's a lot of speculation about what it means, but one of the definitions is revealer of secrets, or savior of the world. Savior of the land. But I love that part that he's 30 years old when he gets. So he was 17 when he first went into, as a slave, 1730, so 13 years he was suffering. Now that's where you can see there is no, it's not a parallel, because Jesus' life was only 1 year, ministry was 1 year, and his time of suffering trial is very short, okay? I'm trying to point out the parallels, but I'm also trying to show you that you can't see every single thing. But like that part about how he's 30, that he, you know, that's the time where in the East they consider a man who's 30 to be of age. So all the time that he's going from 17 to 30 is like training. Get to that place. And Jesus Christ didn't come into his full ministry. And he had a lot of years where he was learning how to be open. Hey, there's just a couple other little things to look at. What happens, so Joseph becomes the ruler, and they do have 7 years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine start. And after the second year, Joseph's brothers and his father are without food, and they hear that there's food in Egypt. So Jacob sends 10 oldest sons to Egypt to get some food, little knowing, of course, that Joseph is there. So the very first incident, let's go over to 42. When they come to see Joseph, he's standing there dispensing the grain and everything. And guess what the brothers do? They end up bowing down to Joseph. And verse 7 says, Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. And he said unto them, whence come ye? Where are you from? And they said, well, from the land of Canaan to buy food. Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. And Joseph remembered the dream which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, you are spies to see the nakedness of the land you are come. And they said unto him, no, my lord, but to buy food. So this starts a time of trial for the brothers. Now, okay, right now Jesus Christ is seated next to the right hand of God. Okay, in the future, Israel is going to go through a time of tribulation and of testing. And hopefully they are going to turn like the brothers end up turning back to God during that time. But the time of tribulation is basically for Israel to have another opportunity to repent and to turn back to God. To acknowledge that, you know, God has done all this stuff for them all through the centuries. And they're going to have, there is going to be a period of 7 year tribulation as well. So Joseph, in a way, he tests his brothers to see what's going to happen. So first he tells them, go get your brother, your youngest brother. And then he puts money back in their sacks. So the first year they come back with all their money and the grain, and they can't come back unless they bring Benjamin. So they wait a whole nother year, and because their father Jacob does not want to let Benjamin go. So, but they run out of food, so they have to go back to Egypt. And so they bring Benjamin with them. This time, when they get the grain, then Joseph has them put his cup and all their money and in the sacks. And then they're halfway out the gate, and he sends his servants out there to say, somebody stole my cup! Who is it? It had to be you! You know, and so the brothers are all upset, you know. We didn't do anything! Well, they open the sacks, and there's the cup, and there's the money. So he's going to take Benjamin. Oh, so Judah, who eventually is the line of the kings, comes from Judah, right? Judah is the one who stands up for Benjamin and says, no, I'll go in your place. So anyway, they come back, and Joseph prepares a feast for all the brothers. And they think they're going to get thrown in prison. But instead, they get taken to this big feast. And so, let's see, where are we? 42. You already read that?
13.
Yeah, about the spies. Okay, flip over to 45 now. So, you know, if you didn't read the story, you should go back and read the whole story of the brothers and what happens to them. So verse 1 says, Joseph could not refrain himself before all of them that stood by him. And he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. He wept aloud and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard. And Joseph said unto his brethren, and Joseph, does my father yet live? And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. And in a way, see, this is what's going to happen to Israel when Jesus Christ finally comes back, and he's on that white horse, and it's the King of Kings, and he sets everything right. They're going to have their mouths on the floor going, I thought we were getting destroyed here, and now all of a sudden it's all getting put back right. The brothers are so typically Israel. It's really cute. And so Joseph says to his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years has the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years which there shall neither be harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. That's exactly what's going to happen. Have a great deliverance, and they are going to receive the promise that God made to Abraham that they would have an inheritance in the land ongoing. It wasn't based on how great they were or how wonderful they acted at all. So, you see the compassion that Joseph has for his brothers and how he sees that, you know, there's God's purpose in the whole thing. So, let's see. There was one verse I wanted to read at the end here. Could I have a glass of water, please? We've been talking about, thanks a lot. Well, turn to Psalm 81. I'll have somebody else read it. I should have had you guys be reading all this stuff.
I'll read it.
Okay, Psalm 81, 3-7.
I'm appointed on a solemn feast day. This was a statute for Israel, of the God went out through the land of Egypt, hands were delivered from the pots. Lost in trouble and
I. Okay, I wanted to show you this passage because it's an example of how you can see how prophecy skips around. Okay, because the verse 5 there, this he ordained in Joseph for a testimony when he went out through the land of Egypt. And he removed his shoulder from the burden, his hand was delivered from the pots. Okay, so God took Joseph out of the prison and raised him up and put him up on high and as the right hand to Pharaoh. So that example, it was a testimony of how God would not only deliver Jesus Christ from death, but that he also delivers us because we are in him, right? We have Christ in us. So when Jesus Christ was raised, we were raised with him. When he ascended, we were ascended with him. When he's going to be glorified, we're going to be glorified with him. Okay, but see the part about the trumpet, the new moon, and the solemn feast? Because this was a statute for Israel. Well, that was a feast, the Feast of the Trumpets, that was established way back. All right? And the trumpets represent a whole different thing. And then also, verse 7 says, thou callest in trouble, and I delivered thee. I answered thee in the secret place of thunder. I proved thee at the waters of Meribah. Meribah is the time of tempting in the wilderness. Israel was in the wilderness. So you see how it skipped? It went from Joseph's life to the time in the wilderness. And in the middle, it's saying, well, I called unto God, and he delivered me. So, I'm just showing you that in just those four verses, the prophecy skipped. And that's David saying that, you know, too. Okay? So, this is what's really cool about seeing the suffering and the glory, is that we can look back and we can see Jesus Christ's life. Yes, he was the beloved Son of the Father. Israel hated him without a cause and sent their shepherds to sell him off. He was sold as a slave for silver. They stripped him of his robe, and he went through all of that. But during his life, he learned obedience just like Joseph did. And then at the very time when it looked the bleakest, those 3 days when Jesus Christ was in the heart of the earth and he was dead, and everybody had lost hope, God raised him from the dead and set the seat in hand, where he now still lives to make intercession for us and is still doing the will of the Father. And there will be a day, you know, when Israel, having gone through their testing, will also have a great, great deliverance. So you can see the simplicity of it when back. And then you don't have to spiritualize it. I wanted to read just a little thing from this book. This is a book where this guy, even though he's a wonderful man, I'm sure, he just goes on off on all sorts of tangents. So I don't recommend this book, okay? but I wanted to read just at the ending of it, because he does say something really, really dark. Says, okay, such as live and walk in the Spirit know that we too are called with this calling, to rule, not to be ruled by, that the kingdom may be in the earth even as it is in heaven. For Christ our head has reached to this, and we are his members, as his members are predestined to be conformed to him. Now that is cool. Because it's Christ in us, which was a mystery that was hid, not in the prophecies. It was hid, but because everything that happens to Jesus Christ, we're conformed to that too. So, but few get beyond faith or sonship. Few reach to service, and fewer still to glory and tribulation. By the cross to rule the world and to walk among the things of senses, confessedly superior to them all. Let such abide their time. They shall show that if we suffer with Christ, we shall also with him be glorified. The whole path is here set forth. How it goes with man in this path, how his very brethren mock him, how the world deals with him before he rules it, how trials increase the more he walks with God, how the battle is won at length. All this is told as none but God, whose own work it is, could tell. Being is proved to be far more than doing. And indeed, there is no service like this unconscious service which naturally flows from what we are through the divine indwelling. Which is a fancy way of saying, it's Christ in you, so